coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Every serious philosopher should realize that Hegel was the outcome of the German idealist movement that Kant had begun.
Dialectic.
Zeitgeist.
The end of history.
The philosophy of Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, one of the most profound thinkers of the 19th century.
It's Hegel's view that the human spirit in history is both trying to realize its idea of itself, and in the process of that, it changes what it is.
Hegel, profound and obscure.
Hegel's famous saying was that the rational is actual and the actual is rational. He thinks even human bad behavior plays a rational role in history.
Our guest is Alan Wood from Stanford University.
You could say that for Hegel, history ends in the present.
The philosophy of Hegel, coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
But we're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, they migrate to this oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog. You don't know what kind of oasis that is, the blog.philosophytalk.org. And now you can listen to the best of Philosophy Talk anytime, anywhere, by downloading one of our podcasts. So, John, we're going to talk about Hegel today. I hope you're an expert on Hegel, because my acquaintance with Hegel is, well, sparse. Let's put it that way.
Ken, you're going to be disappointed. I think we need to be honest with our listeners. We're not going to do our usual job of brilliantly setting up the whole show, drawing on our vast knowledge of all aspects of the problem concerned, because you and I were educated in graduate school at a time and in places where Hegel was not much taught or much thought of. We were taught in analytical places, and Hegel was, you know, the antichrist of analytical philosophy or something like that.
Yeah, you know, Richard Rorty has this remark. I don't know what it means exactly, but he says the problem with analytical philosophy, the kind that you and I cut our teeth on, is that we're stuck in a Kantian moment, and the great thing about the literary critics is that they've advanced to a Hegelian moment. And I don't know, maybe Alan Wood, our guest, can explain that to us. But, you know, I have to tell you something else, though. I'm writing this big book on normativity, and I go around giving talks on it, and people tell me that I'm a Hegelian. So I don't know what they mean by that, but I've decided that I'm going to devote myself to understanding Hegel for part of my summer.
Well, I think that's good, and I'll go you halfway. I'm going to actually buy a copy of The Phenomenology of the Spirit and leave it around to read when I've got really important things to do. And
oh, that's part of your structured procrastination.
Structured procrastination.
But I do think there are a lot of important ideas in Hegel. I mean, this view about history and the development of consciousness, the growth and decay of normative community over time, and you can tell a historical narrative about that, and the way ideas come about and change and converge on something kind of true and deeper and more absolute. I mean, he's got lots of ideas. You know, and he did influence lots of subsequent philosophers, not just continental philosophers, but the pragmatists are in one way kind of Hegelians in a certain sense.
Well, you know, if you think about our colleague Richard Rorty's remark, it's kind of thrilling to think of this coming hour as that moment in our development of analytical philosophers where we go from being stuck in about 1789 when Kant wrote the Critique of Reason and get updated to, I don't know, what, 18 or 10 or whatever it was when Hegel wrote The Phenomenology of the Spirit. Many people would say we're still a little bit behind the times, but at any rate, yeah, to make this huge transition from being stuck in Kant to stuck in Hegel, I hope that we have some experts to help us.
Well, Alan's going to help us, and our roving philosophical reporter went out and talked to someone who knows a lot about both Hegel and history. She files this report.
Hegel's one of the more difficult philosophers for people to understand. According to John McCumber, president of the Hegel Society of America, everyone views Hegelian philosophy differently, even members of the Hegel Society.
He's been defined as Aristotle plus mediation, and what that means is that Aristotle has this huge encyclopedic system, not just philosophy, it encompasses biology and politics and all kinds of things. Hegel has taken over a lot of that content, but the modern side of Hegel is that he develops each part of it out of the previous parts. So the more complex parts, such as a polis, a political society, will presuppose his discussion of biology and chemistry and things like that. So he's tried to relate everything together into this huge, enormous philosophical system, probably the largest that anybody's ever actually created.
McCumber is also a professor of Germanic languages at UCLA. He told me that Hegel is as much a philosopher of language as anything.
He's talking about words. He's not doing philosophy of language the way it's done today, which is focuses on, you know, sentences, but he's talking about lexicographically. He's talking about the words that we use. He's trying to provide definitions. And I think that's really what he sees absolute knowledge as being. It's the only thing that we can, that won't surprise us because we stipulate the meaning. But anything else in the world can surprise us because we'd never know anything fully.
I asked him how Hegel saw history.
My general view is a highly de-reified view. He thinks that history is a learning process in which ideas are tried out. You know, it's kind of Darwinian. There's hundreds of ideas, and a few of them work out, and then they're built upon by subsequent generations. So that's not the idea that there's some sort of gigantic absolute being that is realizing itself through history. That's a more traditional view of Hegel.
Hegel's view of history had a huge impact on the thinking of Karl Marx.
There are similarities in their diagnosis of the times. For both of them, dialectic basically just means looking at everything in time. This too shall pass. Nothing is eternal. From which it follows for Marx that capitalism is going to cease to exist someday, and the question is how? And then he thinks he can predict what's going to happen, and there'll be a revolution, and it'll go through various stages, and then you'll have this wonderful situation with the government withered away and so forth. Hegel thinks everything is going to give way, and nothing is going to last forever, but he does not think the dialectics or anything else can tell you how that's going to happen.
Can we blame Hegel for having any part in what became communism or totalitarianism?
I don't know if you can pin it on him. I wouldn't like it if you could, but, you know, there's so many twists and turns from Hegel, and then you get Marx saying there's going to be a revolution, which Hegel doesn't try to say, and then you get Lenin trying to say this revolution can be steered and guided by a particular cadre of elite people, and then you've got Stalin taking over that cadre, and I think there's a lot of jumps from Hegel to that.
What's Hegel best known for?
I think he's best known for his strenuous attempt to get an overview of the entire human enterprise. I mean, all of human history, art, religion, science, everything.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that very interesting report, and thanks to her guest, John McCumber. I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Alan Wood, back for a repeat visit on Philosophy Talk. Before, he was talking to us about baseball. Today, we've got Hegel. He's a professor of philosophy at Stanford University, author of Hegel's Ethical Thought, and editor and translator of many of Hegel's work. Alan, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks.
Well, Alan, it's good to have you back. And I know a lot more about baseball than I do about Hegel, I'll have to admit. So you're going to have to help. Hegel's indeed the philosopher I probably had the most trouble getting a grip on of all of the ones that are considered truly great, most of whom I've really tried to dig into. In a nutshell, tell us what about Hegel everyone, or at least every serious philosopher, should know.
Well, every serious philosopher should realize that Hegel was the outcome and was seen by everyone at the time as the outcome of the movement that they thought in Germany that Kant had begun. For the German idealist movement was, from the beginning, thought of as something that was in process. And Hegel's mature system came to be seen as the culmination of it.
Help me with that idea. I mean, okay, so I know a fair amount about Kant. I know you know everything about Kant. I guess it has to do with Kant's idea about phenomenon and noumenon and how we can know the phenomenal world, and we've got this noumenal world that we think only is like the limit of the phenomenal, but we can't know anything about it, right? I gather people were dissatisfied with.
Well, Hegel even thought that there was an incoherence in the idea that there were objects that we could think but could not know, because he thought that just thinking of an object was a kind of knowledge. And so if you were to say of an object that you couldn't know it, you'd have to be over on the other side of the line and look back in order to say that, and that means that the claim that there are things we can't know is unintelligible.
Now, when I hear the word idealism, as you just said, he was the culmination of German idealism, My mind, you know, focusing maybe on my old friend Berkeley and Hume, people like that, is that idealism is the idea that the world is basically spiritual or mind-like. Did Hegel believe that?
Hegel thought that there isn't any one category or set of categories or ways of conceptualizing the world that works for all purposes. But he did think that there were more and less adequate ways of conceptualizing it, and the highest way would be to conceptualize it as what he called mind or spirit. But it wouldn't be right to think of Hegel as believing with Berkeley that the only realities are minds and ideas. That's certainly not. He's about as far from that view as you could get.
Let me take you to a quite slightly different topic for a while. I want to talk about, you said Hegel's the culmination of this kind of post-Kantian grappling with what they regarded as Kant's incomplete project. Tell me something about that time and about what was driving people and who was and where Hegel fit in, and just help me put Hegel in his philosophical times a little bit more.
They were that was a time after the French Revolution in which there were enormous social changes, and people were trying to conceptualize these philosophically. It was a very commonly held view that what the French had done in the political realm, the Germans were to do in the philosophical realm.
What is that? Give me that analogy.
Well, the idea is the French were bringing about a new political world, and the Germans were supposed to bring about a new world in the realm of thought. And Hegel was trying to do that through a single encompassing system and way of looking at the world.
And what was supposed to be the great advantage of this new realm of thought, and how it was supposed to solve the problems of the old or supersede the old? I mean, what was the...
Well, the way that Hegel would have conceptualized this, I think, is that we're trying most of all to understand ourselves in the society that we're a part of, that we understand that society as rational, and that makes us free, because now we do what we're doing in the society, and we do it knowing what we're doing and understanding it correctly.
So I'm not quite sure I've got this picture. So we're in a time of great ferment, great social change. All kinds of old institutions are falling away, and we're looking for some kind of philosophical underpinnings for those, and Hegel's going to provide them? Is that the idea?
Yes.
Are these like democratic polity and all that? Is that the...
Well, it wasn't, in Hegel's view, as of just about anyone in that time, democracy isn't a word he would have used. Hegel was a constitutional monarchist. He believed in representative institutions. He believed in a market economy. He had a certain rather encompassing conception of what the modern state should be after the French Revolution. And it was one that involved the freedom of individuals, their rights. It also involved certain kinds of social unity and solidarity that a lot of people wouldn't probably favor now.
So basically, we have individual freedom. We have some representative institutions. But at the top, we have a constitutional monarchy. So I'm seeing the connection between Hegel and modern Republican neoconservatives, because this is essentially what we're evolving into. I guess we're going to shift back and forth between various Bushes. But
one of the ways in which Hegel would not like contemporary conservatism is that while he thought there should be a market economy, he thought the economy should be fairly strictly regulated by the state, because he was worried that it would lead to all kinds of discrepancies between rich and poor. And he was very much worried by the arising of a class of people who didn't feel connected or in any kind of solidarity with the society as a whole.
This is where Marx first got the idea from alienation. Did he just crib that from Hegel? Or
I think there is a... There's the beginnings in Hegel of the Marxian idea of the proletariat as a revolutionary class. Hegel didn't want to see it that way, because he wanted to see the contemporary society as one in which we could feel at home and understand ourselves rationally. Both Hegel and Marx thought that it was very common for people not to be able to understand themselves rationally in the society they lived in. Marx thought that you couldn't understand yourself rationally and accept life in this society, and Hegel thought you could.
Just a couple of words about Hegel's personal life. Was he from a rich family, a poor family, a Protestant family, a Catholic family? Where did he come from?
He came from Southwest Germany. His father was a middle-class civil servant. He was a Protestant. He was a middle-class civil servant's son, and who became a civil servant, because an academic in those days was a civil servant.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is the philosophy of Georg Hegel. Our guest is Alan Wood from Stanford University.
We've been talking about the life and times of Hegel and some of the basic reasons he's important. In the next segment, we'll delve further into his view of reality, concepts, and contradiction. You can join by calling 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, toll free 1-800-525-9917.
Reality, concepts, and contradictions. Hegel's view and your views too when Philosophy Talk continues.
Richard Wagner, Ride of Valkyries. Wagner was inspired by Hegelian thought. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic today is Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. Have you been touched by the writings of Hegel? Reading it over the fireside? Give us your thoughts about Hegel.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. And from all around the world, even from Jena, you can send us email at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Alan Wood from Stanford University, and we've got a caller in the line, Esther in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Esther.
Hi.
Hi. What's your comment or question?
Well, I'm anxious to hear more about the term zeitgeist. And how Hegel sort of related to that. And I'm wondering, specifically, it sounds like this idea of social, sort of a social unity of I don't know, I can't decide if the term would be sort of political thought or spiritual underpinnings. I'm wondering if your guest can maybe flesh that out a little bit. I originally was going to ask if what relationship Hegel might have had to Spinoza, if any, but I think I'm more interested in the social, political, and or spiritual component. So,
okay, Esther, thanks. You're allowed to change your mind. So let's talk about Hegel's social and political. Let me press this question a little bit, because you said something about wanting us to feel at home in the society we're in and wanting to feel we're rational. Hegel's going to has this project of rationalizing, in a way, the society we're in and rationalizing our feeling of home in it. But, you know, history's a mess. Society's a mess. The society I live in is the outcome. Take the French Revolution. You know, especially at certain points in that whole thing, it's just a mess. It's just a struggle for power, or this power-hungry group over that power-hungry group. What's this thing about rationalizing society and making us feel at home in this historical mess, this whirl and twirl?
Well, Hegel's famous saying was that the rational is actual and the actual is rational. When he said that, he didn't mean that everything that exists is rational. He thought that the basic structure of the world, including the basic structure of society, was rational. But there are accidents that happen to people. And he thinks it's a necessary truth about us that we are subject to these accidents. If someone's relative were to be run over by a truck, that's just an accidental fact. There's nothing rational about that. Hegel would differ from some people who try to justify God's ways by saying that there must have been some secret purpose to that. Hegel's answer, on the other hand, is this is simply an aspect of the world that falls outside the rational, outside the actual. It's merely the transitory and contingent. What he was trying to do in philosophy is to get us to understand the essentials of society, of nature, that make sense, that make rational sense.
So tell me more about this. So is it that the development of society over time, the growth of social formations and cultural formations is like all the work of reason? Is that the view that, you know, you see reason working itself out over time and giving rise to this cultural formation and then that cultural formation and that social organization? I mean, tell me about that.
That's right, yes. Reason operates through stages. Each stage has its own kind of society, which Hegel would call a form of ethical life. Each society has its own way of thinking about art, religion, and philosophy. And societies go through periods of growth, maturity, decline, and then there are often tumultuous, radical periods in which things change very rapidly. Hegel is trying to develop a theory of history on which you can make sense of these changes.
Now, we've got some email that is right on that. This is from Polly in Pomona, and she says, "My understanding of Hegel was that his fundamental idea was that history proceeds in this triad, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Wasn't that his main idea, and can you explain it?"
Well, that terminology, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, was used by some of Hegel's predecessors, Fichte and Schelling. But Hegel never used them except when he was describing the views of Fichte and Schelling. When somebody describes Hegel in that way, they are actually telling you something that they're not intending to, namely that they probably haven't read Hegel.
So take that, Polly and Pomona, but we hope you keep listening to Philosophy Talk.
But walk me through a little bit of a concrete example about social and historical development and how we can see it as different stages of reason. I mean, pick your favorite example that's most easily accessible.
Well, the most important thing about the modern world for Hegel is the emergence in it of a new kind of institution, which Hegel calls civil society. Civil society starts with the market economy, but it's not just that for Hegel. It's a set of social identities and roles that are connected with your economic activity and that connect people to each other and to society. Hegel didn't think that there was such an institution in earlier stages, and he connected the idea of civil society with the idea of individuals as free subjects who choose their own mode of life. And it's the emergence of the individual in the modern world that comes along with this institution.
So the individual as a free subject who chooses his or own life, that's a certain kind of his cultural formation at a certain point of history. And before that, there were no individuals who chose their own lives? I mean, maybe people didn't think of them.
People didn't value individuality, in Hegel's view, until the modern world. They didn't build the valuation of individuality into their social structure.
Were our non-modern precursors, were they mistaken, benighted, or did our coming to value individuality thereby make it to be valued?
Well, it's Hegel's view that the human spirit in history is both trying to realize its idea of itself, and in the process of that, it changes what it is. It changes the idea that it should realize. So it's not that people in the past simply didn't know something about themselves. It's that in the past, they hadn't yet become what it takes to value an individual.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Join us within the 415 area code, 841-4134. That's 841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. Here's your chance to learn about Hegel, something you've probably always wanted to do.
You make that, what you just said, makes Hegel sound like a kind of relativist. In people who did not see themselves as free individuals freely choosing their lives, who lived, I don't know, in some kind of feudal order, it was not the case that they were free individuals freely choosing their lives. People who lived in a civil society with a market economy became, by their own valuing, something different. So it's kind of there's a kind of relativism there, and a kind of I don't know, historical social constitution of stuff.
There's some truth to that. If you would have put to Hegel the question whether his philosophy is relativistic, he would have said definitely not. He thinks that the way we look at things in the modern world is a deeper and truer way of looking at them than people were capable of in past societies. And so he doesn't think that it's that they're all just different and not commensurable. He thinks that the modern world understands things more rationally.
So we've got an email here. This is from a fellow named Jack, who's on Gower Street, University College London, not far from where Marx worked out some of his ideas. And he says, listening to your excellent philosophy talk program on the Internet, could you say a little bit more about Hegel's concept of dialectic and how it relates to Marx's idea of dialectical materialism?
Yeah. Well, maybe I should say the term dialectical materialism was never used by Marx or by Engels.
Yes, Joe Wolf.
So
that
isn't Marx's concept.
Yes, yes.
Hegel's dialectic is perhaps best thought of as a way of, that he thinks different categories or concepts show their limitations and develop into others in his system of speculative logic. He wants to develop all the different repertoire of concepts that we have, and he doesn't think that any of them apply universally everywhere. Some of them give you a deeper understanding of reality than others, and the way that you derive them is by finding that they show their limitations when they run into philosophical contradictions, and you resolve the contradictions by moving on to the next concept.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Hegel with Alan Wood. Join our discussion, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. Although Hegel's a hard philosopher to read, he's a really profound guy, and Alan is helping us see into the depths of Hegel. Ed in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ed.
Oh, hi. I'm afraid to go forward. I share with my colleague in London to feel like yes, I don't know anything at all about Hegel. I think it's thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And so I hesitate to ask what I was going to ask, but I'll ask my original question and pervert it into something more, possibly more interesting. Is there a difference between text and a detail? Constructionist concept and a thesis, but of course, you know, he didn't have the concept. He just used somebody else's. So maybe we can compare it to Heisenberg's problem about knowledge versus and evolution, the Darwin thing. It sounds like there's a little bit of both of those in there.
So Ed asks if he apologizes for formulating his question before we learned about the thesis antithesis. Synthesis not really being Hegel's idea, but he says, isn't this notion of thesis that's somehow there in Hegel similar to the deconstructionist ideas?
Well, many deconstructionists think of themselves as Hegelians. They're not the first in the 20th century to try to get the Hegelian idea that thought falls into contradictions and incoherences, but to leave out the thought that it can resolve these at a higher level. And I would say that that's the way deconstructionists, like a lot of earlier Hegelians in the 20th century, differ from Hegel himself.
Tell me if this is a crazy thought. I think of pragmatists as kind of Hegelians without Hegelian metaphysics. That is, they think inquiry is this walk through a space of possibilities. There's lots of wrong turns. There's some right turns. I mean, and we get to at the, quote, end of inquiry, we get to a point of convergence in which it's all done, and we can now tell a story retrospectively about what that walk was like and which turns were wrong turns and which turns were right turns. But before we get to that end point, we can't tell any such story. But it's just trying out, and then projects come crashing down, and we try it again, and some project comes crashing down. But they've got that kind of story without kind of the absolute spirit coming to know itself. Is that a crazy thought?
No, I think that's actually fairly close. One way in which Hegel would differ from the pragmatists is that he thinks that there is a principled reason for trying to make our understanding of history converge at the best understanding of the present that we can come up with.
So speaking of the pragmatists, back in that same era was Hosiah Royce. And I used to read Hosiah Royce, and maybe that's where I came to many misconceptions about German idealism. Because for Josiah Royce, the absolute spirit was really spirit, right? I mean, that was a real mover and shaker in the universe. At least that's how I remember it. We live in this world of mind. But you use the term absolute spirit with Hegel, but he doesn't mean that by it, I take it.
Well, what Hegel means by absolute spirit, the religious name for it is God. But Hegel's views about God are not very orthodox. Maybe this is the point at which to address the question that the earlier caller had about Hegel and Spinoza. Both Hegel and Spinoza think that there is really only one ultimate reality, and you could call it God, but there isn't any room for separating absolutely God off from the world. The world isn't some separate thing that God creates. I think you could describe Hegel's view by saying that God is the fact that the world has a rational structure.
Right.
There is no separate God.
I want to go back to Hegel. He seems like political stuff, because he seems like a deeply conservative philosopher in a way. And we've got a caller on the line, Randall in Oakland, who has a question, I think, pertinent to this issue. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Randall.
Thank you. Thank you. I love Hegel sounds like a Unitarian, kind of.
Well, sort of. Maybe. Well, what's your question or comment?
My question is a little more specific. It's dealing with what did Hegel think about the institution of marriage? Because during his era, I'm sure that institution was very hard and specific and concrete.
Oh, Hegel has lots of things about the family.
Well, he has quite a bit to say about that. Some things in relative to his time were progressive in that he didn't accept the idea of arranged marriages that had to do with the broader feudal extended family. His conception of the family was the bourgeois nuclear family. This is part of his emphasis on civil society. But from the standpoint of contemporary feminism, Hegel was very conservative. He thought that the place of the woman was to rule over the household and the place of the man was to go out into the world. He was simply conceptualizing the institution of marriage as it was in his time.
Well, now, his Fichte got fired from that job that Hegel later had for being an atheist, and then Schelling left because he was running off with another man's wife. Did Hegel ever do anything kind of radical and interesting in his life?
Well, he did have an illegitimate child by his married landlady.
Oh.
And this was part of his reason for leaving Jena behind after the Battle of Jena,
this
in which Napoleon defeated.
Pretty seamy professorship.
Really quickly, though, back to family and marriage and back to also the civil society and the market economy. Marx thought that the market economy would destroy things like family. He has this thing in the Communist Manifesto, capitalism destroys all relationships between man and man except the calculations of raw self-interest or something like that,
mm-hmm.
Right? Is there any thought like that in Hegel, that because the market economy regards, we become free, autonomous, self-choosing individuals, and because family is another kind of source of constraint, that they can't really coexist? Is there any thought like that
well,
in Hegel?
Well, this is one reason that Hegel wanted the market economy to be structured around a set of customary social roles, so that you don't have just atomistic homo economicus. Hegel is quite hostile to the idea of a society in which people were seen as simply self-interested atoms. His defense of the market economy was one in which both state regulation and other social institutions connected to the market would moderate its influence and keep it from being what Marx is afraid it was becoming.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Hegel with Alan Wood from Stanford University.
We've been examining Hegel's views of reality and the development of concepts. In the next segment, we'll synthesize some of this by tackling Hegel's idea of zeitgeist and the progress of history.
Zeitgeist, history, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
The The Propeller Heads, featuring Miss Shirley Bassey and History Repeating. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the philosophy of Hegel, and we're about to launch into his philosophy of history. What do you think about history? Is history just one big mess? You know, the powerful winning out over the weak, things going astray? Or is there a progression to history? Is history reason working itself out over time? Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. And finally, you can email us comments at philosophytalk.org. Our guest is our colleague from Stanford, Alan Wood.
We've got lots of lines open, so give us a call. Alan, look, I don't know about this thing about the end of history. Fukuyama wrote this book, The End of History, supposedly inspired by Hegel. I tend to think of history as a mess, as just a mess, a constant struggle. Sometimes reason triumphs, sometimes illusion, sometimes superstition. What makes Hegel believe that history is kind of reason working itself? Why believe that?
Well, about the end of history, I would say the idea that Hegel believed in an end of history isn't something you'll find in Hegel. It's something you'll find in a Russian emigre to France named Alexander Kojève, who wrote lectures on Hegel's phenomenology in the 1930s. And that's what Fukuyama is reacting to.
So this is kind of pseudo-Hegel.
It's pseudo-Hegel. Hegel does think that we are limited in what we can know about society and, in fact, about everything else by the historical present. The future is something which we cannot really properly conceive or know anything about. So you could say that, well, maybe it sounds trivial, but for Hegel, the history ends in the present.
Right. But he does have a view, is it? I mean, he wrote a book called Reason in History, right? Isn't that right?
Yeah.
And he does have a view, as I understand it, that history is, in some sense, the work of reason, the work of spirit coming to self-knowledge. If you look at history, I mean, it looks to me like just a mess. It's kind of accidental. Who wins? Who loses? Mm-hmm. I mean, we could have lived in a world in which Hitler triumphed, and then how would that look? Would that look like the work of reason? That's just the work of power, you know?
Yes. Well, Hegel doesn't think that history is just accidents and just bad behavior. He thinks even human bad behavior plays a rational role in history. Some of his most radical ideas are about the way what he calls world historical individuals, people like Julius Caesar and Napoleon, bring about radical change in history. He thinks that they are morally very bad people, but there are unconscious purposes working through their actions.
Why does he think that?
Well, because he thinks that at each stage in history, there is a set of norms, what he calls ethical life, and the only way that a new form of society can be brought about is through tearing down the old. And it takes these ambitious, passionate, unprincipled men to do that.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the philosophy of Georg Hegel with Alan Wood of Stanford University. Give us a call, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And we've got a caller on the line, Sue in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sue. Hi.
Good to listen to your conversation. I do believe that you can predict the future, that history really does repeat itself and that winners do write history. And that you introduced this topic by saying, is it true that the wealthy and the elite do win out over others? I've just finished researching a book since 4000 BC, and it appears to me that whether you're the leaders religiously, politically, or scientifically, that you seem to take on this fascist mindset that seems to want to win, and that we've become a society, a world that is addicted to control. I know it's a trite phrase right now, but I think it has some merit.
You sound a little pessimistic.
I do. I am. I like I said, I've just been studying history for the last 9 years, and
So Sue, I
value kindness greatly now, much more than I ever did before, especially from people who have money, and I come from a family with some wealth. So.
Thanks, Sue. Sue, I think I share your dark vision, pessimistic vision of history and the dynamics of it. it seems to me that, Alan, can you convince me in a few minutes, using arguments from Hegel, that the dynamic of history really is a dynamic of reason, kind of walking through a space of possibilities and settling on...
Let me just ask a preliminary question. When we talk about history, are we talking about the actual accidental morass of events, or are we talking about history as what we construct looking back, picking and choosing among those things in order to make sense? The last is a work of reason, but that's no big surprise, right?
Well, that's the second thing is our way of gaining some kind of intelligibility out of the first kind of thing. And as I said a while ago, Hegel thinks there is a certain realm of contingency, accident, human error, human bad behavior that we can't make rational sense of.
But here's the way I could accept Hegel. Taking off from Sue's remark, the winners write the history. And here's the kind of what humans do when they write the history, when they tell a narrative of their own coming to be. They tell a narrative that's a narrative of progress toward them, right? And deviations away from them are a history of mistakes. So whoever writes the history will tell it in a progressive way, right? But if somebody else had won, you know, if the slaveholders had won the Civil War, they would tell a story about how the slaveholding South ultimately triumphed, and that was the work of reason. So it's all just rationalization. It's not really anything deeper. I mean, could Hegel accept that?
Well, you could have people writing history and getting it wrong. Hegel's idea is that you can comprehend history, you can see how things got to be where they are, and you can make rational sense of it.
But wait a minute. You said to me, you kind of accepted this kind of reading of Hegel as having a relativistic side. Right, because the guys who didn't cognize themselves as free autonomous beings choosing their lives, they weren't free autonomous beings choosing their lives. So now we who have come to see ourselves and have thereby made ourselves this, when we tell the story, we'll tell it in our own terms. But if those guys had told the story, they'd tell it in their terms, and the terms would be completely different, right?
Well,
and
the
so
aim
it's
of...
Kind, isn't it, yeah. Aren't we kind of hostage... Isn't the kind of rational outcome of history kind of hostage to...
If we can tell a rational story leading to the way things were, that is supposed to give us a reason for thinking that they couldn't have turned out otherwise.
So we've got an email here, Alan, from an analytical philosopher, Peter in Oakland. To summarize, he says, look, Hegel sounds very interesting, a lot of interesting ideas. They sound mostly like spiritual musings. But as analytical philosophers, aren't we supposed to hear some arguments? Has he got any arguments that we should believe this big theory he's got?
If you look at a book like The Phenomenology of Spirit, the standards of argument that Hegel sets for himself are extremely high. He thinks he's running through all the possible wrong ways of looking at the world and showing how each one destroys itself. Now, it's another question whether Hegel succeeds in executing argumentatively everything that... But, of course, that's a big question with respect to Descartes or Kant or anybody
else.
This
is our emailer there, self-identified as an analytic philosopher. I want to take you back and tell me if you understand what Rorty meant. See, Rorty says, the problem with analytic philosopher and with our emailer is we're all stuck in this Kantian moment, and literary criticism has transcended analytic philosophy, and it's the new queen of the humanities or something, and they're in the Hegelian moment. What? You know what Rorty meant?
Well, I don't want to be in a position of interpreting Rorty, but I do think that he accepts a picture that a lot of both Kantians and Hegelians accept that I don't, that you have to choose between the two. I don't want to choose between the two. I think they are part of the same project.
What's this choice about, choosing between Kant and Hegel, by people who accept
that? Well, that's
a
very big question.
Can you do it in 30
seconds?
It's often
that the Kantians think you should be more modest about what you think you can know, and the Hegelians think that there is absolutely no limits to this.
So, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the element of truth in what Rorty says, if I could put it in my own way, would be that Hegel thinks that you can conceptualize and understand the world in all sorts of ways, including those of the natural sciences and those of the social sciences and those of the humanities. But Hegel thinks that there is a priority among them and that the more adequate ones are the ones that have to do with the humanities. To put it broadly. And that, I think, is probably what Rorty has in mind.
You know, I think I can get to that same point by remaining stuck in my own moment, which is a Humean moment. I don't even go to Kant. Hume had a lot of room for the knowledge involved in the humanities, in my humble opinion.
Alan, that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a really great conversation.
Okay, well, thank you. I've enjoyed it, too.
Our guest has been Alan Wood, professor of philosophy from Stanford University, friend and colleague, author of Hegel's Ethical Thought, and editor and translator of many of Hegel's writings.
We want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to, and I've just got a pile of interesting email we didn't get a chance to get to. Thanks a lot. Sometimes we read your email and it has influence on us, even if we can't work it in.
The reason we didn't get to some of that email is because they send it to the ideas address rather than the comment address. So don't make that mistake again, guys, okay? So John, what did we learn today? Are you wiser? Have you synthesized the antithesis and the thesis?
Well, on the hypothetical supposition that I thought that Hegel said thesis, antithesis, synthesis, I won't ever say it again. Nor will I. I also learned that Marx didn't call himself a dialectical materialist. I also learned that Hegel's fascinating, and I better get busy and get up to speed on Hegel.
Yeah, you know what? I think I don't think I am a Hegelian, but I think I have views like Hegel's without Hegel's mistakes. So, you know what? If you really want to learn the truth, the Hegelian sort of truth, read my book when it's done.
We're gonna have to get you some self-esteem lessons, Ken.
Right. Anyway, this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. We've spent the last hour investigating the life and times of Hegel. But to wrap it all up in a nice little package, we leave the last word to Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. In 1989, Francis Fukuyama wrote an essay called The End of History for the neoconservative journal The National Interest. In it, he claimed that democracy has won against all other forms of governance. The world won't be clear sailing, war on terror, anyone. But as he puts it, quote, liberal democracy may constitute the end point of mankind's ideological evolution, unquote. Fukuyama cited Georg Hegel, from whom the concept of an end to history derives. History had to have an end purpose, Hegel believed, or it would lead to what he called a bad infinity. But Fukuyama took his view of Hegel from a Russian philosopher named Alexander Kohevi, who called himself a Marxist of the right. So this is Hegel as filtered through Fukuyama, through Kohevi, through Marx. Democracy may mark the Hegelian end of history, but others have made Hegel the cause of both Marxism and fascism. He's also been called a metaphysician, a pantheist, the precursor of existentialism, a Gnostic, the first holistic philosopher, an apologist for Marx, and worse. Karl Popper called Hegel's philosophy bombastic and mystifying Kant. Bertrand Russell said he was the hardest to understand of the great philosophers. Hegel's colleague Schopenhauer said, quote, the height of audacity in serving up pure nonsense and stringing together senseless and extravagant mazes of words, such as had only been previously known in madhouses, was finally reached in Hegel, unquote. But he could have been jealous. Hegel was a very popular teacher. Schopenhauer was not. His former friend Friedrich Schelling said of Hegel after his death that his philosophy was shallow and superficial. Schelling also harbored resentment toward Hegel, who had surpassed him in reputation. Schelling's students, by the way, included Friedrich Engels, Søren Kierkegaard, and the future anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, all of whom produced their own views of Hegel's views. As soon as he died, Hegel's followers had split into two camps, the left Hegelians, atheists, and the right Hegelians, Christian fundamentalists, all of whom found a Hegel to their liking. Hegel's like the elephant described by the blind man. How can one philosopher mean so many things to so many people? Well, for one, Hegel was the exact opposite of a tabula rasa. He wrote a lot of words, in other words, trying to come up basically with a theory of everything, in prose both opaque and obscure. In fact, there are dozens of Hegelian glossaries out there necessary, it seems, for a reader to wade through his work. One of his concepts, for example, is something called Aufheben, in English, sublation. To sublate is to simultaneously supersede, end, and preserve something. You begin to see how tricky Hegel is. He used it to mean that even when an old idea is refuted, it is still contained in the new idea. Maybe that's what happens with Hegel. His readers cherry-pick what they want from him, declare that the cherry is now an apple, and either ignore the rest of the fruit or question the motives of those who pick it. For the rest of us to know what Hegel really thought, that would require, you know, reading him, all of him, with the glossaries in German. That's a lot of fruit. I gotta go.
Ken, my head is dizzy from 60 seconds of rapid-fire philosophy.
If your head is dizzy, that means you've got a conundrum in your mind, and we can solve it for you, can't we, John?
Yes. Go to our webpage,
conundrums@philosophytalk.org, or hit that conundrums button on the webpage. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
We owe special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Timpson, and Alan Farley. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, including the Stanford Humanities Center, the Office of the Dean of Research, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, and the Provost and President.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.